You know, everyone, I think, has gone through an experience at least once that changes your life forever. Remember when I was growing up, my dad had a buddy named Chester, and Chester didn't have the top part of his thumb. And, of course, he was always doing one of those things with it. I can't do it. But, you know, playing, messing with your head, because he'd do the old, I have a thumb, I don't have a thumb. And then he'd hold up that hand that didn't have a thumb, and you'd go, whoa, he's, that's a pretty good trick. But I used to ask him, how'd you do that? And he talked about just being a kid, and he was doing something. I think it had to do with a table saw, something like that. And he was, you know, looked away or stopped paying attention, and zip, no thumb. Now, it wasn't the end of the world. I mean, it hurt, but it healed up, and he learned to deal with it. But it changed his life forever. You know, the biggest thing for him was with his, I think it was on his right hand, and he couldn't grab a beer without that thumb, you know, Uncle Chet. That's the way that worked. But it changed his life forever, and we all go through things like that. Maybe it's not something as, you know, negative as that. Maybe you think back on the day that you met your husband or wife-to-be, you know, that first blush of infatuation, and you kind of walk on a cloud and you can't think of anything else. And then, you know, you end up getting hitched, and then you end up raising a family, and, you know, your life definitely changed forever just on that one day. Or if that wasn't the day that changed it all for you, surely the day that your first child was born, especially with guys. I mean, we can, you know, we're married and all that, and we can give up, you know, hanging with the boys like we used to and kind of get into this couple thing and go with the flow, and then, oh, well, we're going to have a little one. And you kind of go through the whole pregnancy season, you know, those months, and you don't really know what's up, you know, but you're into it. Maybe you're excited about it. But then when the doctor hands you that little wrinkled, slimy, most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your whole life, all of a sudden everything is in perspective. I better get my act together. I better, you know, make sure I provide for this family. I better start thinking about raising this little one up, you know, and it just changes everything for the whole rest of your life. You know what I'm talking about? Well, that's how it is when a person surrenders their sin to Jesus and connects for the first time ever with their Creator. When that conversion is genuine, not just a trip that lasts a while, but when it's the real deal, it changes your life forever. And I don't just mean for the rest of your life here, I mean forever, as in eternally. Now, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, where Jesus takes his closest followers aside and says, in effect, this is what I want you to know. Now, in the first few verses, he's described a process that begins with the realization that in and of ourselves, we have nothing to offer God, nothing that makes us appealing to him. And that puts us in the position of having to rely completely on his mercy, on his grace, on his goodness. But see, that's exactly the position he wants us in. Blessed are the poor in spirit. The next part of the process is when we realize the damage that sin has done, and that everything about our lives is subject to the consequences of sin's presence in the world. You know, the fact is, we don't have the foggiest idea of what life apart from sin might be like. And it's the realization that Jesus not only died for my sin, but because of my sin, that stirs up a sense of grief that only God can comfort. Blessed are those who mourn. Now, once I have that accurate assessment of who I am, a sinner with an evil heart, in light of an accurate assessment of who God is, you know, loving, gracious, forgiving, understanding creator, keeper of promises and all that, then I can finally surrender my life completely to the Lord. Blessed are the meek or the humble. Now, with those inner attitude adjustments in place, my desire changes from temporary pleasures and false promises to the righteousness or the rightness of God. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And it's at this point in his teaching that Jesus turns a corner as what's been going on in my spirit and in my soul begins to show on the outside. As the mercy that has been shown me, I now begin to show towards others. Blessed are the merciful. Now today, as we pick up our study in verse 8, we see three more of these outward manifestations of that process. And what Jesus wants you to know is that you will be changed. There's no maybe about it. We're all on a slightly different schedule, but if our conversion is genuine, if our faith is real, if we're true believers as opposed to make believers, we will be changed. And the result of all these changes, as we've seen, is a sense of well-being, blessedness, that the world can't give or take away. So let's start reading in verse 8 of Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to read down through verse 12 to finish off this first section that we normally think of as the Beatitudes. Verse 8, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." You know, I've seen this entire section, the Beatitudes, called the Beatitudes. You know, attitudes that we're supposed to have or attitudes that we're supposed to be. I don't really go along with that. I don't think it's accurate. I know the word beatitude is just, as we've talked about before, comes from that word blessed, which some translations translate as happy. Although, as we've said, it's way more than just happy. You know, I'm really happy my package came in the mail the other day. That's not this. This isn't that kind of happy. The blessedness, the makarios, is that sense of well-being that can only come from God. In fact, some commentators go so far as to say it's that sense of being that is what the Godhead, Father, Son, and Spirit, experience in and among themselves, that kind of satisfaction and well-being. There's no loneliness. There's no emptiness. There's no neediness, just that utter, complete sense of well-being. Now, as we wrap the section up here in verse 8, the first thing this passage draws our attention to do has to do with a, what did I say? Has to do? Did to do? Let me try it again. Take two. The first of these changes that this passage has to do with is a pure heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now let's just take the language apart a little bit. Blessed are those with a pure heart, or blessed are the pure in heart. This word pure, it's the Greek word katharos. That might sound a little familiar. It's akin to our English word catharsis. I don't know if you're familiar with that. A catharsis is... let me describe it rather than define it. A catharsis is the way it feels after you have a good cry. Can you relate to that? think maybe you're dealing with an immediate situation, or maybe it's just life in general kind of has you frustrated and you don't really know what's going on, but I just got to let this out. And you cry for a while, a few minutes or whatever, and you just, you know, you let her rip, the tears flow, and you're gasping for breath, and you're just, you know, and then, but when you're all done, nothing's changed on the outside, but boy, don't you just feel better? That's the idea here of pure. That's part of the idea, that katharos or catharsis. The word literally means to be cleansed. Now, that's in contrast to being clean by nature. The assumption is we are not clean and we need to be cleansed. You know, it doesn't mean that you are clean, but it means that you've been made clean. Now, the Hebrew Bible uses this word, this is a Greek translation of a Hebrew word that they would use in temple worship that would describe something that was ceremonially unclean but is now clean. You know, there was a long list. If you did anything wrong, if you walked too far on the Sabbath, you're unclean. If you had occasion to touch a dead body, whether that's human or animal or whatever, you were unclean. And so there was this process of being made or being declared clean again. That's what this word means, declared clean after a cleansing. Probably an easy way to understand it for us, this katharos, this pure, is to understand that it means we're free from the pollution and the guilt of sin. Now, I remember what that feels like, I remember the night in that little tiny apartment, and I gave my life to the Lord. And again, nothing had changed on the outside. The apartment was just as tiny. I still had the same habits and the same bad attitudes. But man, just to know that, to understand for the first time really that because of God's grace and by means of faith, I was forgiven. I was cleansed. I was free from that burden of guilt and remorse, the debt that I felt I owed God, a debt that I felt was unpayable, a debt that I decided in my own, you know, limited stinking thinking that precluded me from any hope of fellowship with God under any circumstances. So I just walked away, walked without God, and to understand that, no, man, that's not the case anymore. You're free from all that. You're cleansed of all that. You're made pure. Oh, that is an exhilarating experience. So blessed are the pure in heart. Now, that's real simple. By heart, he means your inner self, the real you. Not the you that behaves a certain way or talks a certain way or even thinks a certain way, but it has more to do with your motives, your desires, your intentions, your purpose. You might even say it's the me that is no longer me-centered. It's me with me out of the way. It's me that understands I'm a sinner saved by grace. I've gone through this whole process of understanding humility, that I'm mourning for my sin and all the rest. And now here I am, the real me, the born again me, the true me, cleansed from sin, pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, what does that mean? Do I suddenly get, you know, 3D glasses that allow me to see things I never saw before? Well, not literally. It's not as though God is a ghost hovering around and some people can see him and some people can't. It's not that kind of literal seeing. But in a sense, it means to discern or to recognize not only God's presence, but God's power and all the rest. We see... In fact, everyone can see God's presence in the beauty of creation. You know, the staunchest atheist or agnostic or whatever you might be, can look at the beauty of creation, whether it's the surf or the snow or the trees or sunset or sunrise or, you know, the volcano or whatever it is, and there's something in our heart that just resonates. And whether we sort of fall back on that prideful position that it all just happened, or whether we, in our heart of hearts, recognize there's something going on here. You know, there's something behind all this. We see that. But do we see God in calamity? Not usually. You know, do we see God's care and provision for victims of tragedy? You know, do you realize that the friends and family that come to support you in times of need are a reflection of God's nature? I mean, the basis for family is God. The basis for friendship is God. The basis for society and government. The basis for fellowship. The basis for us interacting and depending on one another is all based on God's nature. And there's this thing that happens in our spirit, in our soul, as we follow down this process from stepping stone to stepping stone, where we begin to see God. Because our motives are pure and our hearts have been cleansed and we're free from the guilt and condemnation of sin, we begin to see God's presence, not just in the good things, the flowers and the rainbows, but we begin to see God's presence and power and influence even in the calamities that befall us or befall, you know, life in the world. Do we recognize God in God's love and patience for those that reject Him? Because I've been praying for certain people, you know, as long as I've been praying, since the first time I prayed for myself, Father, forgive me. And, you know, it's been cool to see some of those prayers come to fruition. And some of those prayers, though, some of those people have just continue on this path of, if they're not stubbornly resisting God, they are just choosing to ignore Him. And sometimes, you know, like, there's a lot of times where we wonder, well, what's the Lord doing? He's not answering my prayer. Is the answer no? Gosh, it seems like a good thing that this one would come to faith. How can God say no to that? Maybe He's teaching me patience, persistence, all the rest. But do you see in God's patience, in sort of allowing this one to bide their time, God's love and God's concern, God's kingdom, you know, God's nature? That's part of seeing God. You know, I'll never forget, you know, I was in Japan 30 years ago when the day the volcano blew up. And of course, in Japan, you know, the word was the entire West Coast had been blown into the ocean. And I tried to call home and I couldn't get through. So I didn't know any better for a few hours, you know. And finally I got through to Mary and I said, I says in the Stars and Stripes that the volcano blew up. She says, yeah, I saw that on the news. Okay, good. You know, it didn't wipe you out. The house is not, you know, I was envisioning one of those things like that nuclear bomb blast where everything just goes flying. So it wasn't that, but then, you know, I got home and there's, you know, obviously we were all aware of all the pictures and the photographs, the films, the, you know, the documentaries about, oh, well, this, you know, because of this blast, life will never be the same on Mount St. Helens. It'll be 100 years before a tree grows back, and it'll be 200 before a chipmunk comes back to live. And then it's like a couple of months later, you see this little green sprout poking up through that gray ash. And see, when you're the pure in heart, the way that Jesus is telling us here, you not only see that and marvel at it and go, wow, isn't nature cool? No, you see God's hand in that. You see Him in that. You see His nature. I guess what he's getting at here, what I'm getting at, is you don't just see God when your attention is on Him. You know, we come to church on Sunday mornings and some once a month Sunday night and whatever else, home groups and all the rest, Bible studies. And when you come to one of those events or one of those occasions, you kind of expect, you know, to see something, hear something, feel something, learn something that kind of tickles your God funny bone. But when you're out and about the world and you kind of forget about all that, you're not really expecting to see that stuff. But what he's telling us here is that that's what changes. You do begin to recognize God, not just in the good things, but in the bad things. You know, it's not just when things come your way, but in everything, everywhere, all the time. Now, this, you know, purity of heart and the consequences of it are the first tangible, experiential outcome of the process that Jesus is talking about in this whole passage, in fact, throughout the rest of this Sermon on the Mount. When you come to terms with your own spiritual poverty and receive the riches of God's grace, when the full impact of the consequences of sin reaches your head and your heart, when you realize who you are and how you fit into God's kingdom, and you begin to crave right living, right thinking, right decisions, right being, really, not in some religious, legalistic, follow the rules, toe the line sense, but in a very organic, ontological, a very natural way, you begin to experience that, begin to crave life according to God, according to God's righteousness, then, verse 8 tells us, you're finally free from that poison and pollution of the flesh-driven life, and you begin to see God, his presence, his power, his influence in everything. Listen to the way the Message paraphrases verse 8. You're blessed when you get your inside world, that is your mind and heart, put right. Then you can see God in the outside world. You want to see what God's doing? It always reminds me of that story, Elisha and Elijah, you know, and Elisha's kind of freaking out because there's no way they can win this situation. And Elijah just kind of prays, Lord, open his eyes. And suddenly Elisha sees, you know, warriors, thousands and thousands of angelic warriors there to defend them and fight that battle that he sees, thinks is hopeless. Well, in a sense, that's what the Lord is getting at here. When we go through this whole process and the result is a pure heart, pure motives, then we begin to see God's hand, not just God's handiwork, but God's presence and power in life in general, in our very being. You're blessed when you get your inside world, your mind and heart, put right. Then you can see God in the outside world. Okay, that's the first one. Now, the next change that this passage brings to our attention in verse 9 has to do with being a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Let me paraphrase that for you in my own personal paraphrase. When you burn to bring God's peace to others, that's when you know you're God's child. See, this peacemaking is not a reference to some kind of generic political or social peacemaking. You know, he's not saying that you become the Henry Kissinger of your, or who's in charge of that now? Some gal, I can't think of her name. Secretary of State, you know, he's not saying, it's not that kind of peacemaker. It's not going to the Hatfields and McCoys and saying, can't we work something out? Let's negotiate. Let's come to it. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's about resolving the conflict that exists between man's natural spirit and God's supernatural spirit. That's the kind of peacemaking, and the peacemaker is that person. See, as a result of seeing God's existence, as a result of seeing our existence, this existence, from God's perspective, you find yourself discovering that the real conflict that prevents peace in the heart of man has very little, if anything, to do with circumstances and surroundings. It's not a lack of financial security. It's not a lack of perfect health or a lack of perfect relationships that keeps peace away. It's not the things that you might think make a so-called better life in human terms that causes discontent and dissatisfaction. What causes that kind of dissatisfaction is being disconnected from the Creator. And what solves that problem for all of us is being reconnected to the reason for and the source of all life. And that is why we can't escape the fact, and why would we want to, that Jesus is absolutely central. I mean, duh, right? But sometimes we need a reminder or an explanation of why that is the case. Hold your place in Matthew and turn up to Romans chapter 3. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans chapter 3. And find verse 10. Now here we have the apostle quoting a conglomeration of Old Testament passages, but starting in Romans 3, verse 10. As it is written, there's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There's none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There's none who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. There is no appreciation of who God really is before their eyes. Well, you read that passage and you got to realize that Jesus undid all that. That's the mess he came to clean up. He undid it. He made it possible to escape that. But without him, or and without him, we're stuck with that. That Romans 3:10 passage. You know, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, housing the homeless, those are all wonderful expressions of care and concern. Jesus said, whatever you do for the least of these, you do for me. But if that's all we do, if all we do is treat or address the symptoms and never get around to the disease, we really, I think the word for that is cruel. We're just being cruel, because none of those things bring peace with God. They just make us more comfortable this side of spending an eternity of regret and remorse. But blessed are the peacemakers. This is what Romans 10:15 says. How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. Now, when it comes to verse 9, the message doesn't quite hit the bullseye. It's close. Let me show you what I mean. I'll read this and then I'll sort of fix it. Here's the message version of, or paraphrase of verse 9. You're blessed when you can show people how to cooperate instead of compete or fight. That's how he interprets peacemaker. That's when you discover who you really are and your place in God's family. Now, here's my adjustment to that paraphrase. You're blessed when you can show people how to cooperate with God's Spirit. That's when you discover who you really are and your place in the family of God. You don't. Children imitate their parents. I remember being, it wasn't here, it was another church, and we were, I think it must have been vacation Bible school or something. I was out on the playground, and there were some kids playing, and I was standing next to a couple of moms. And one of the little girls, she was maybe 8, 9, 10 years old, they were playing and running around. And then I'll never forget, she kind of looked at her friends. Her friends were saying, well, come on, you know, Nancy or whatever her name was, come on. And she put her hands on her hip like this and she went, I am so tired. And I looked at the mom, and the mom turned so red. Children imitate their parents, for better or worse. When we put ourselves, our comfort, our security on the line to bring God's peace, that's when we show ourselves to be children of God. Now, what he's talking about here in a word is evangelism, but let's be careful. I have never liked it when somebody beats me over the head with some sort of "you better go out and share your faith" rant, and then lays a guilt trip on me about what's wrong with me if I don't. I just don't. I've never liked that, and I still don't. And so I would never do that to anyone else. See, evangelism, this being a peacemaker that Jesus is talking about, it has to flow from a pure heart. That's why verse 8 comes before verse 9. You can't reverse those two. Faith and patience dictate that we don't try to cram salvation down somebody's throat just so we can put another notch, you know, on our gospel six gun. But it also dictates that we have a burden for the lost, a desire to bring the peace of God. And that's why Romans 10 says, "How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace." Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Verse 10, this is the third change that this passage draws our attention to. It has to do with being persecuted. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Underline that or highlight that if you need to. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. When you're persecuted for going after God's best, that's when you know you're part of God's kingdom. Now, it says, well, first of all, to be persecuted, what this word refers to is being driven away with harassment and hostility, or harassment, if you want to be more politically correct. But that's what the word literally means. That's the definition, to be driven away with harassment and hostility. In a positive sense, this word is sometimes used kind of upside down. It can mean to run after something with everything you've got. But as it's used here, it means to run away from the threat of physical bodily harm. Blessed are you when you're in a position where you got to make tracks or you're in real trouble. And why are we in trouble? Why are we being persecuted? For righteousness' sake. That's the part you want to underline or highlight. Because it's not just a persecution for being obnoxious. You know what I mean? Sometimes we do more harm than good. Why we, I mean the people in the church. We just do. I've seen it, been there, done that, seen that, heard that. It doesn't say, you know, blessed are those who are persecuted for acting goofy or saying goofy things. So, you know, that's not what he says. Realize, maybe be reminded, that the basic claims of Christianity, of biblical Christianity, are reasonable, they are rational, they are logical, as well as historically and scientifically verifiable. So why then are unbelievers so inclined to want to run us off as soon as they see us coming? Well, it's because too often we misrepresent God's truth and God's nature. Don't we? And we may not mean to. Well, some of us, we think we're doing the right thing, but we don't know God well enough. We haven't spent the time invested in developing the relationship that we really know him and know his heart and know his nature. So we create God in our own image based on what little we do know and 99% assumption. And then we parade around representing God, and this is what the Lord is like, and this is what he wants you to do, and this is what he requires of you, and this is what he'll do if you don't straighten up, you know. And then people kind of like, you know, get out of here. I don't want anything to do with you. You're freaking me out. You're bugging me at the very least, and when I see you coming, I'm going to go the other way. And if I bump into you around the corner, and if push comes to shove, I'm just going to run you off because I don't need that in my life. I don't want that in my life. Now, that's when people misrepresent who God is. See, if all people know about God is what they see in and hear from you, you better get it right. I'm reminded, this hit me as I was going through this study again this morning. You know how in the Psalms there'll be a passage and then that little word Selah, S-E-L-A-H, and maybe you've studied and understand that that word means pause a minute and think about what you just said. Well, I got a big Selah as I was going through the notes. If all people know about God is what they see in and hear from you, you better get it right. Stop and think about that for a minute. That's scary. That can hurt. I actually knew a fella years ago. He was one of our crowd of, you know, pagan musicians. And I don't know how it happened, but he got saved. He got the call, you know, and we, of course, had a great time making fun of him when he wasn't around, because that's what we do, never to his face, at least not too much. But I got to tell you, I don't know exactly what this guy got into as far as teaching or different denominations and things, whatever he was under the influence of. It was something that we didn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole, and we just didn't want to have anything to do with him because all we knew about God was what he told us and showed us with his life. And even in our lostness, in our, you know, debauched, pagan, you know, selfish, flesh-driven, worldly lives, we knew that that just couldn't be right, that that just wasn't something we were ever going to be interested in. If all people know is what they see in and hear from you, we have a responsibility to get it right. Now, when you do get it right, persecution is a given. Making the world feel like they need to run you off, you know, kind of throw rocks at you as you go down the path, that's just a given. And verse 11 and 12 tells us, a badge of honor. Look at verse 11. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely. And here, underline this or highlight this. For my sake, not for your goofiness sake, not for your misrepresentation sake, but for my sake, says the Lord, the words in red. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. When you get it right, persecution is both a given and a badge of honor. You know, this was true then, it's true now, and it's only going to get truer and truer. It's only going to get worse as things go along. So the lesson here is expect it and realize that when you find yourself in that position, being, you know, what's the words he uses here? Reviled, persecuted, you know, spoken all kinds of evil, you know, or all kinds of evil spoken against you and so forth. Rejoice, you know that the time is at hand. Things are coming. You know, it's bad enough to deal with we'll forget the adjective, and call him your brother-in-law. Okay, that stupid brother-in-law. It's hard enough to deal with him every Thanksgiving, and you're going to go to church on Sunday, and he's going to make a point to kind of rub your nose in it, and you know, and you got to deal with him somehow, or you get the emails from your second cousin twice removed, or even your mom and dad, brother or sister or best friend. Oh, no, you know, we were such great friends in high school, and now I heard that you've become a Christian. I never thought you'd make such a stupid mistake and buy into that God baloney with Jesus in the Bible and all that. And then you have to, you know, what do? You're kind of confronted with this reality and you have to deal with it. Well, see, that's bad enough. We all deal with that. You know, I gotta tell you, I love my my daughter's in-laws are wonderful people. They're generous. They're, you know, helpful, supportive, and all that. But you get a couple of beers down them because they're not Jesus followers. And you get a couple of beers down them, and the tongue kind of loosens up a little bit, you know, and stuff will come out like we're having a family picnic and it looks like it's going to rain. Why don't you just pray about it? You know, come on. You'd never do that without the beers, but that's, you know, even we all have to deal with that kind of stuff. But here's what's coming. Here's what's definitely coming, and there's probably a lot we could, you know, take a guess at, but this is what for sure is coming because of your faith in Jesus, for my sake, says Jesus. The tax laws are going to change. They're being changed. For the church, that means no more exemptions. For you, that means that there's no write-off for your tithes, gifts, and offerings. That's coming down the pike. They're fixing, from their perspective, that. Won't be long before our right to gather together like this is challenged. Now, it may not happen next month or next year, but 5 years, 10 years from now, it may be illegal to do this the way it already is in some other countries, like China, for example. Our right, your right, to proclaim God's truth will soon be considered a hate crime. What? You know, brother, I really love you, and I just can't stand the idea of you spending eternity apart from God. And I want to tell you that Jesus died for your sins. And if you'll just put your trust in him, you'll be forgiven. You'll be cleansed. You'll be restored to a right relationship with your Creator. You'll experience life like you've never experienced it here and now. And then, you know, when this body wears out and gives up the ghost, as they say, you'll go to spend eternity in a world that you can't even imagine. Is so wonderful and so beautiful. And that's when they come and put your hands behind your back, you know, up against the wall, come with me. That's what our society is on its way to. Can you believe that? When sharing the gospel becomes a hate crime. Last June, when I was down in California at the pastor's conference, there was one session where Pastor Chuck answered questions that guys had written, and they collected them, and he answered some questions. And one of the questions he answered was, what are you going to do when it becomes a hate crime to proclaim God's love and the rescue from sin that's available by grace through faith in Jesus Christ? And he said, I guess I'll just have to preach in jail, won't I? Well, I think I just have to go with him too. I don't want to be confronted with that reality. I don't want to be put to the test on that. I really don't. Maybe the Lord will come before it reaches that point, but that's where things are headed. Again, those are the things that are being enacted or worked on for real right now. Listen to the message here. This is, again, Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of verses 10 through 12, this whole part of this whole subject of persecution for your faith. You're blessed when your commitment to God provokes persecution. The persecution drives you even deeper into God's kingdom. Not only that, count yourselves blessed every time people put you down or throw you out or speak lies about you to discredit me. What it means is that the truth is too close for comfort and they are uncomfortable. You can be glad when that happens. Give a cheer even, for though they don't like it, I do. And all heaven applauds. And you know that you're in good company, because my prophets and witnesses have always gotten into this kind of trouble. You will be changed. As the Spirit of God guides you through this process, these changes are inevitable, they are desirable, they're profitable. You know, if you resist, the Spirit will back off. He's never forced anyone into a given over to God life. So if you resist him, you'll stop hearing from him. But if you'll surrender to and cooperate with the Spirit, you will be changed. That is what Jesus wants you to know.